After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Everyone, it's Raghu. I'm back with Ram Dass here and now. And this episode is very interesting. I never heard it. I know. I say to myself, how could that happen? But it did. And this is interesting because it's the style of the talk that he gave, which was all the way back in 75, January 1975, it has him as his in his psychologist mode, at least as to get the thing going. And it's around reference groups. I'm going to explain what that is because it'll be good to have a handle on that before one listens to this. But before I go there, I do want to say, I mean, this is what, November of 2021, early November, and I'm about to suggest a phenomenal Christmas present. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable that I would even think of such a thing. We have a fantastic book coming out this month, Words of Wisdom from Ram Dass, that was put together in a way that it's an easy reference to core teachings, key teachings. Of course, it's done so that it's very short quotes from Ram Dass. Now, some of it's not that short. Some of them are like a couple of paragraphs or more. But I do love the way it was put together so that you can just turn to a section and a topic that needs attention or that you feel could use some attention. So it's one of those books you just have on the coffee table that you can just turn to and even set your day. And so we are now taking pre-orders, which all of this, of course, goes a long way to help support everything that we do. But if you just go to ramdass.org/shop, just go to the ramdass.org shop, and you will be able to pre-order the book, which does a lot because it helps in terms of getting more interest from people like booksellers and so on, Barnes and Noble and Amazon and all of that. They will make it look, make it easier for people who file into the stores to find the book. So that helps. Words of Wisdom from Ram Dass. And let us pray. Let us pray. Ram Dass, reference groups are groups that an individual identifies with. So it's a family group, it's a religious group, it's a business group, it's a union, a bowling group, a national group. Now, we are all very familiar, are we not, with the various groups that exist, and it has become tribal groups. Even in our era, as it is now, of course, with COVID and all of the different protocols and the solutions, including vaccination, have, as we well know in this country, it's a very, very prominent split. There's the anti-vaxxers and then there's the pro-vaxxers. And just look at how we think about each other. It's pretty far out. And so he talks about us and them. And our us and them, of course, it's so evident. It's like worldwide evident. This is going on everywhere. Although I think in the United States, there's even a much sharper divide. And of course, that includes everything that's going on politically, socially, environmentally. And all of this is based on reference groups. And so I think that at some point, we really do have to recognize this. I mean, we are recognizing it, and there's a bit of malaise in my mind going on about just not being able to even think of how we can approach each other. And it feels like such a dark wall. Just when this whole thing with the of course the political thing, it seems more obvious, but with the COVID thing where people taking these kinds of very intractable stands around getting vaccinated or not getting vaccinated, it's a very, very tough situation. And Ram Dass talks about, and this is key, he kind of loosens up out of the his professorial. That's why this thing is really far out. I've never heard him be, quote-unquote, a Richard Alpert, as Ram Dass, defining, you know, the reference groups, defining the us and thems. And then finally, not finally, but at some point, and which is what we are all realizing, that the level of which that we focus on individual differences and just how do we categorize that, just walking down the street. So the change that can happen is one gets behind that usual mind judgmental perspective to a new identity which sees all as souls, which Ram Dass accomplished in this life, you know? I mean, he said he would always say, I'm not a guru. I am just like everyone working on myself to become free. And, you know, some of us are a little further along the road. And he obviously had gotten to a point where he actually, it was experiential loving everyone. And so at that point, it's just a soul meeting ground in which we see each other and we see the packages that we are displaying. What did Jack Kornfield and Ram Dass, we were at a retreat in Maui. I think they referred to that package as a meat hanger. Is that it? I wonder if I have that right. It sounds just about right, though. The package just is just that. And the veil, once you are meeting on soul ground, the veil then is very, very thin. So he talks a lot also about different spiritual communities that got together, or communities that come along with a very strong central purpose, and people unite around it because of their common interest in that purpose. And then he talked about things like back in the day in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, there was a thing called the farm. Where were they? In the south somewhere, Georgia maybe, Tennessee. Steve Gaskin, I'm not sure where they're at right now, but Ram Dass talked about it. This is, of course, 1975. And they had a huge experiment of being inclusive and not being focused around any one central religious or spiritual figure or teaching. And so he talks a lot about that. And so it reminded me of what we're doing at Love, Serve, Remember Foundation. Ram Dass is gone almost 2 years now. And how we are interacting the way that, as much as we can, feel how he interacted with all of this. There was no isms. Yes, of course, Maharaji Neem Karoli, Baba, was the inspiration for everything for those of us that were in India, and how Ram Dass shared that with us. And of course that's there, but that is only representative of that which is part of the complete interconnection of everything. And that's what Maharaji is, that unconditional love connector that is in all of us. And when one identifies Ram Dass, as Ram Dass says, this reference group, this is the soul reference, it would be the Ram Dass soul reference group, the community of the spirit, then where one is in physical time and space, who one is with, whatever the circumstances may be, becomes less and less relevant. And this is the trick, to move ourselves into a reference group which is way more inclusive, because it's based on who we are behind all of the personality and so on. So this is an amazing talk, actually. Reference groups and the spiritual community. So don't forget about the new Ram Dass book, Words of Wisdom. And go to ramdass.org/shop. I think shop or store, shop, I think. You'll find it. And just pre-order it. It'll be a wonderful thing. You can pre-order a few copies that'll come for Christmas. That will be for sure happening. Tanya will take care and make sure everybody gets their books well before Christmas, and you could even, give them as presents. This is a great present. So just go, you can go check it out anyhow. And again, this is Ram Dass Here and Now on the Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And boy, there's a lot of great podcasts. And we have a new one coming up next week that is Madison Margolin, who is starting for us a psychedelic podcast investigating psychedelics and therapy and everything that's happening in that area, which is really quite powerful these days. See you next week.
There is a term in psychology and sociology called reference group. Refers to the group with which an individual identifies as perhaps the basic group. For example, the family is such a reference group for many, and their primary identification is with the family. For others, their religion is a basic reference group. Or their club. Maybe the bowling club is the basic reference group. And they generally think of themselves as members of the bowling club, who also work, etc. Or maybe a union. Or a national organization. Or a nation. And now, as the world has gotten smaller and smaller through the advent of jet transportation and the television media, radio media, we come to what McLuhan describes as the global village. And for some of us now, the reference group is all of humanity. And I'm sure it is obvious to you when you reflect upon it that the nature of one's reference group has a lot to do with how you deal with a variety of social and economic problems in the world around you. If your reference group is very small, then only within that group is it us, and the rest of the universe is them. And there is certainly a certain appropriate behavior regarding thems, which is different from that regarding us's. On the other hand, if your reference group includes all of humanity, then there is no them, at least not in the human kingdom, so that it is difficult to impose various economic or moral discriminations when there is only us. In general, governments function on the basis of the nation being the basic reference group and other countries being them, so that if a single human being happens to be a member of one country versus another, we justify a differential treatment so that we feed everybody in our country, but if literally millions are starving to death this year in Africa and Bangladesh and India, we feel somewhat less connected with them, at least from a government point of view, because they are them, not us. Those of us that have been awakened to our global identity experience a tremendous sense of frustration with the policies of a government which has this different kind of frame of reference. Now, within these reference groups, the reasons for identifying with a group vary. We may join a living group, for example, rent a large house in the city or go into an apartment community, specifically for economic reasons, because it's cheaper to live together than apart. That is a very different kind of a community than one that has come together for, say, artistic appreciation. For example, a community of artists, or for spiritual growth, which might be called a spiritual community. The present communities that exist in the United States, the younger communities, I'm not talking about the Quaker and Shaker communities and so on that have been existing, the Adamites and so on, that have been existing for a long time in this country, but the more recent communal endeavors have fruitful and useful confusion as to their basic identity. There are very few of these communities that are single-purposed and therefore have such a definite function that they attract only people who share a single goal. Examples of this very clearly defined communal game would be, say, a Benedictine monastery or a Zen center, the Zen center, say, at Tassajara or something like that. But most of the communes that are in the countrysides on the East Coast or the West Coast or now spreading really throughout the country and with concentrations, say, in Colorado and New Mexico and Arizona and the Northwest and New York State and so on. These communes have an economic justification which is very comparable to the frontier mentality that existed in this country not so many years ago. And in addition to the economic justification, many of them have a spiritual justification as well. And they are loosely organized around a single spiritual a program or a much more eclectic type of spiritual feasting. And the communities that have a single spiritual format or connection, such as, say, those that are studying with Kirpal Singh or the Ananda Marg or the fundamentalist Christian groups or the Buddhist or Zen Buddhist groups. For the most part, these structures come from without the community. That is, they either come through textual material, through holy books, manuals, all the way from very specific things, such as, say, the rules of St. Benedict or St. Ignatius, the Buddhist Shila, purification rules, from some headquarters of the organization. This is the case with, say, the Guru Maharaji group or Integrated Yoga Institute. other communities which are not committed to a single tradition or lineage tend to have the order and organization and structure come from within the group, and either using visiting teachers or shared reading of and study of books or shared experiences that have been often individually collected by the members in their studies and travels prior to entering into the community. Stephen Gaskin's farm would be an example of this kind of an undertaking, which does not really honor a specific lineage other than the attempt of a group of people to become conscious together. Now, there are obvious assets and liabilities to these various kinds of communities, participation in these communities. The ones that have the structure from without have a way of controlling the kinds of ego games that people get involved in when they live together closely. And there is a stabilizing influence which is often transmitted either through the abbot or guru of the group or through the tapes or books that transmit the lineage. These scenes tend to develop a little bit of the guru says type people. That is, it attracts an individual who often likes to be dependent on a somewhat authoritarian structure and feels security in always knowing where she or he is at. The more exquisite and subtle of these lineage-transmitting institutions have self-destruct mechanisms in them which ultimately eject the sadhak or spiritual seeker at the point where that dependency is no longer functional, and that ejection occurs either through the spiritual practices which make the individual see the irrelevance of the institution, or through formal technical initiations and graduations and other forms of expulsion or transfer, as it's called. The other kind of communities which don't have this lineage transmission structure are more of a free-for-all, and they often, at worst, degenerate into just incredible neurosis on everybody's part, power struggles as to whose vision of the universe is higher than someone else's. And that often is determined more by the charisma of the individuals involved than by the wisdom of the individuals. At best, such communities have a number of protective devices that they collaboratively agree to incorporate into their living style, such as group meditations, silent days, and structures of meeting and rotating directorships and so on to protect themselves from the tyranny of the ego. Because it's very difficult when you are in the quicksand to, all of you are in the quicksand to escape. And you can merely set up the best set of rules that you collectively can come up with to optimize the possibility that the least caught person will be heard. That's the best one I've come up with yet about these situations. The community that I'm quite familiar with, the Lama Foundation in New Mexico, which I visited a number of times and have been very close to spiritually, would be considered a spiritual, educational community, which has its grounding in regular meditations, in bringing in outside spiritual teachers, and in which everybody in the community participates in a intensive program, whether it be Zen Buddhism or Sufi training, for a period of a week or 2 weeks or even 3 weeks. In addition, there are hermitages for retreats, and there is a cross-fertilization with a number of other spiritual scenes throughout the world, because the members of the community are encouraged really to go out and participate in various training programs, and then to return and bring that richness to the community. What evolves in such a community is that the individuals that are the more stable members of such a community are attracted differentially to different spiritual groups. So that, for example, at Lamas, some of the members are mainly connected with the Native American church, the Taos Pueblo of the Native American church, and they spend a lot of time with the American Indians there. Others are very actively involved in the Sufi tradition and involved in Sufi dance and Sufi literature. Others are students of Hasid, of the Kabbalah, and study with Zalman Schachter, a beautiful Hasid rabbi. Others are very attracted to Zen, and when Suzaki Roshi comes, they consider him their primary teachers. Others are attracted to Tibetan Buddhism and enjoy Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche as their primary teacher. Hari Das Baba, who was one of my teachers, spends time there, and there are many of them there that are very attracted to him. So that even though all of them participate in most of the programs, there are very marked individual differences in which aspects are most meaningful to each individual. The liability of this is that you are really not sharing the intensive satsang or sangha or spiritual community of people doing the exact same practices as you are. And you have got to have a deeper philosophical connection with the other members of the community to recognize that even though our practices differ, the goal is one. And of course, that even gets a little confusing when you're dealing between primarily dualistic traditions and primarily non-dualistic traditions. The assets of such variety within a single community is that there is a intense cross-fertilization. There is less of an tendency to get stuck in a single method. Often when you go to communities that are very narrow in their practices, you see an awful lot of dry, tight people who seem quite caught in a practice and have lost the frame of reference or framework to give that practice a more profound spiritual meaning. At this point, I could go into the economics of communes, because I have been very much interested as a participant and observer in what would be called the alternative culture, the economics of it, and the way in which right livelihood, as the Buddhists call it, has been achieved or not achieved in these communities. And there's quite a difference between city communities and rural communities with this regard. And very few communities are economically stable based on production from within the community. The communities support themselves generally in a variety of ways, ranging from in the old days, it was a common practice that they were pushers. That is less common nowadays. But to crafts, which they market in urban areas or in festivals, publishing. Now, places like Steve Gaskin's farm are developing basic crops, which are paying crops. That's moving towards a more economic stable base, although I don't think Steve's place is yet economically totally independent of outside help. Some of the communes, especially the communities that are connected with a lineage, earn their livelihood through the transmission of the lineage, through running seminars and training institutes. For example, things like Eureka or Tale of the Tiger or places like that. Of course, the city communities are quite a different matter, and some of the rural ones as well. There, the livelihood often comes through the individuals going out to work at part-time or even full-time jobs. It would be a common practice, say, in a Guru Maharaji ashram in a city for maybe 60-70% of the people, maybe even, in the Kripal Singh, everybody has to work, so everybody would have a job of some sort or another. But rather than spend the remainder of the tape talking about the externals of communities, I'd rather focus in on exactly what spiritual function communities play, or what is the spiritual community, or why is it that people do band together out of a sense of spiritual urgency or need or purpose. In the past 15 years, there has been an increasing malaise or sort of mild depression in this culture. What the determinants of that are probably much too complicated for us to consider at this moment. They were things like the imminence of total destruction through the development of the atomic and then the hydrogen bomb, the affluence in the culture, which showed people that even when you got what you wanted, it wasn't enough, and the media, which projected that image in huge color all over the world. The realization that education and technology was not a path to happiness and fulfillment by itself. The increasing discomfort with the morality of the government in terms of its foreign policies and, more recently, of course, its domestic policies. In the early 60s, we had the God is dead, this kind of cynicism that goes along with the hierarchy of the priest class composed of scientists and psychiatrists. And adjustment became a valued commodity, coping and adjustment. The despair or the depression attendant to this state of affairs, which is kind of the obvious outcome of philosophical materialism, in which when you're dead, you're dead, and so get it all while you can, and then getting it all, and then having it not be enough, so that the justification for your life is empty. A kind of despair drove a lot of people in a lot of different directions in the 60s. And for a significant, though small, number of people, it drove them into psychedelics and into other kinds of drugs, the opiates and so on, trying to seek more gratification and more intense experience, or more meaning to human existence. Others traveled to other cultures, such as the Far East, Middle East, Europe, South America. Others left the highly technological society and moved back into the backlands, where they could find justification for their existence within a kind of frontier mentality, where they could justify their lives merely by survival, which is getting enough wood and food and shelter and clothing. Somewhere in the midst of this, a process is involved in which the external forms of gratification start to lose their meaning a little bit, and people turn within, and they start to look at deeper places in themselves, either through despair or through some form of awakening or opening. The literature of the late 60s and early 70s started to abound with concerns for mysticism in the East, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sufism, Middle East. The Hasid movement has started to come back into flower. Esoteric Christianity has become noticeable, along with fundamental Christianity, which is not esoteric at all. This turning within to a deeper or higher connection or reference group, the spiritual community, occurred through all of the different vehicles I mentioned, through travels to the East, through drugs, through dropping out. There wasn't any single path that determined that. At first it was a few, and then more and more of the cultural media started to take over the transmission of a new reference group, so that the Beatles first, and Bob Dylan, and followed by many, many people in the rock movement and in the folk music movement, started to make statements concerning this alternative reference group, which was not based on the physical plane particularly. It was a community of the spirit. Now, in order to understand what this community of the spirit is, if you just think of a cross and think that all of the reference groups we talked about up until now, family, bowling club, nation, religion, etc., are on a horizontal axis of the cross, and now we're starting to deal with the vertical axis, to understand how far out that is and how much you must stretch your definition of what constitutes a group, let me say that the spiritual group, reference group, exists over time and space in all directions, so that one begins to recognize members of one's group quite independent of geography and quite independent of time, that is, whether that being is living in the present or not, so that one begins to experience a more intimate identity or family membership with, say, a Socrates or a Plato or a Heraclitus or Chuang Tzu or Lao Tzu or a Buddha or a Krishna or Hanuman, Ramakrishna, Ramana Maharshi, Hazrat Anayat Khan, Rumi, Kabir, the Baal Shem Tov, Saint John, Brother Lawrence, the Pilgrim, and so on and so on and so on. Don Juan. A more intimate relationship with these people than with people in one's own time and space locus. It furthermore occurs that as one focuses into a deeper place in oneself, one perceives a deeper place in another individual. And this depth of perception leads to quite a shift in what would be called figure and ground. For example, if you are preoccupied with your physical body, like either into weightlifting or beauty or ugliness or deformity or something, you will be very preoccupied with other people's physical form. If, on the other hand, your primary concern is personality and you are aware of your own personality dynamics, you'll be inclined to see other people in terms of their personalities as the dominant theme. If you're primarily into astrology in yourself and you think of yourself as a Leo or a Sagittarius or an Aries, you're inclined to see other people as that way. In other words, which individual differences you focus upon. Like if you're balding like I am, years ago I was very aware of who had hair and who didn't. Now that I look at a different place in other people, it is totally irrelevant whether they have hair or don't have hair or what color it is. And as I've found a place in myself that has nothing to do with age, I'm not even noticing any longer whether people are old or young. And as I've gotten into a place that isn't involved with whether I'm depressed or related or joyful or sad, I'm less inclined to label other people as manic depressive or paranoid schizophrenic or psychopathic or what have you. As one goes deeper into oneself, one comes to the soul, one comes to the essence, one comes to the doorway through to a much different kind of identity than the one on which one has been functioning from the time of birth and which was transmitted through one's parents. And when you begin to recognize this new identity in yourself, simultaneously you begin to perceive it in other people. So that when you look into the eyes of another person from this space, you often, not often, but now and then, look into the eyes of another being who is experiencing that same identity with soul. And it's as if you meet as soul mates, or at least a soul meeting, in which all of the packaging of personality, of astrology, of body, is merely packaging. And one, as it were, looks through the veil of this package from one to another, and there is the rather delightful interchange of, are you in there? Yeah, are you in there? Far out, here we are. We're both inside here, and it's as if it's like a Martian takeover. It's as if you're meeting another being who is almost masquerading as a human being, but is in fact not terribly identified with their physical plane envelope, if you will, or temple or package. And that contact through the eyes defines now the spiritual community, because it is really a community of souls. It is not a community of men and women, because in the world of souls, there are no men's souls and women's souls. There are just soul souls. At this point, this discussion gets a little farther out, and for those of you who are not particularly versed in the mystic tradition in any religions or in terms of your own experience, you may find this part of our discussion a little less palatable than what we've had up until now. By the same token that you recognize another individual who identifies with and knows their own soul through eyes, through contact of eyes, so you also know it through listening to their speech or reading their books. And thus, the community of the spirit starts to exist among souls across time and space. And so you will find this incredible intimacy, as if you are sharing an inside joke with somebody like Chuang Tzu or Lao Tzu or Baal Shem Tov or etc., Hazrat Anayat Khan, and on and on. Jesus, Buddha, Zoroaster, Ramakrishna, Ramana Maharshi. Once one has identified with this particular reference group, that is the community of the spirit, then where one is in physical time and space, who one's living with, what one is doing in terms of livelihood and so on, becomes less and less relevant, because the eggs are no longer totally in the basket of the physical plane. So one does what one needs to do to keep the body temple together, and then one immerses oneself into the spiritual community. The vehicles for entering into the spiritual community are the various forms of what would be called yoga, would be one way of approaching these different paths. And there is the bhakti path, or the path of devotion, prayer, sacrifice. There is jnana yoga, the process of using the mind to beat the mind, and of study. There is the practices of karma yoga, or the offering the fruits of one's efforts up. It's a form of devotion, actually. There is dhyana yoga, which became Chan and then Zen, which is a technique of concentration, bringing the mind to one-pointedness, along with a certain kind of insight or mindfulness that leads into samadhi, or intense concentration, trance states. There is Tantra yoga. There are yogic forms that work with energy called Kundalini yoga, and so on and so forth. From within this reference group of the spiritual community, one looks out at each individual one meets as more or less conscious of their participation, because one sees the spiritual community as involving all of, at least all of mankind. We'll maybe talk a little more about what else it involves in a moment. And the individual differences one notices revolve around the degree of awakenedness or realization of one's predicament. That is, you look at somebody and see that they are busy identifying with their physical body. Recently, for example, I was visiting a man who has a very advanced stage of cancer. And he's been in extreme pain for maybe 8 months. Such pain that he's preoccupied with the pain. That is his reality. And whether the doctors will give him strong enough medicine and whether he should jump out the window. And he's a professional scientist, trained scientist, in his 60s, I guess. And when I tried to talk to him, it obviously wasn't going to do much to give him another reference group, another reality from which he could view his predicament. So I asked him if I could massage his feet. And as I was doing this, through this other contact, which was totally kinesthetic through the skin, we entered a space together where he started to experience very intense bliss. And he said, "Where is the pain? The pain is all gone." And I said, "No, the pain still exists, but it's at a different reality than the one you're in now. You've just shifted television channels, if you will, and you're in another place." And he said, "This is the first time in 8 months that I've had a moment free of pain." And I said, "Well, that I that had the pain is still around, but this is another part of the I. And this I doesn't have pain, it never had pain, nor will it ever have pain. And now the game is to break the identification that is consuming the one to the reality in which the pain exists, and to develop an identification with this I, which can see the pain, but which is not busy being caught in the experiencing of it. The game ultimately is not to deny the plane in which the pain exists, but to live simultaneously in many planes." That at that moment, he was being introduced into the spiritual community, a community of beings who meet, as it were, in a different plane of reality. A few years ago, in the West, the group of people that I would feel most akin to were people between the ages of, say, 12 and 18 or 20, because they were the ones who had the least commitment to the existing cultural structure and were therefore more open to these changes in states of consciousness. Now it seems to have spread, and I find that or maybe I've gotten rid of that expectation. So now I find that people of all ages and all walks of life are available to relating on the domain of the spirit. As one enters into this spiritual community, you can't help but imagine what it would be like were everybody living in such a community. That is, everybody living within the sight of God, everybody living with the living spirit. Because in these conditions, there is no them. One is so little attached to the physical plane reality that sharing isn't any more discomforting than possessing. In fact, the possession at the expense of another would be quite uncomfortable, not from a guilt or social stigma, but just from a sense of absurdity. To understand the spiritual community is to realize that there is no form that is unique to the spirit. There is no particular action that a free being has to do. There are no rules to the game. But one's appreciation of the spirit makes the meaning of life so profoundly different that there is not an aspect of one's life that is unchanged by this growth. The meaning of every act, from the most apparently trivial to the most profound, is influenced by this new recognition of the deeper reality behind the facade that most of us have thought was what the game was about. For to tune into the flow, to realize the divine law, to begin to see the workings of karma, to even meet the beings in the cosmic hierarchy, and to plumb the depths beyond even those illusions, to come into the light of God, gives a depth of meaning paradoxically mixed with a recognition of the total irrelevancy of the human melodrama. To live with that paradox, to live with the paradox of the unbearable suffering that one now identifies with through one's identification with the human condition, simultaneous with the incredible bliss and ecstasy that comes from being at one with the universe. To live with the one and the two simultaneously. This paradox is so profound and one's horizon so expanded by this inner work that ultimately one can only fall on one's knees. In awe, in praise, in love to that which lies behind all of the realities of form, be they physical, astral, causal. But to be a free member of the spiritual community means not only to look upward into the light, but to look downward as well, to the human condition. For if looking up, for if joining the spiritual community makes one insensitive to the physical plane sufferings of our fellow human beings, then we are seeing but an aspect of God. For the caring, for the genuine caring for our fellow beings on this plane, along with remembering to look up. For without that looking up, one merely gets caught in do-gooding and more suffering. It's that combination of looking up and looking down, of being without attachment in the Buddhist pure mind sense, and at the same moment having the total involvement that allows you to share the suffering of Christ on the cross daily. Daily anew in all of the suffering of the world around you, with your heart wide open and the full blast of that suffering burning through you. That paradox of attachment and non-attachment, the paradox of heart and mind, it is in the space which transcends all of these paradoxes, which incorporates all of them. It is in that space that we meet as a spiritual community. It's in that space that we come to know ourselves as the true God. May I wish you all peace, the deepest peace in your hearts, a peace of such depth that in that quiet, soft light, you can begin to hear and to know your own soul, your own divinity, your own membership in the family of God.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at Ramdas.org. We can then continue to share what Ramdas has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.